Now, without further ado, I want to welcome my colleague, esteemed colleague, Richard Franklin, to offer our first keynote in his own inimitable style. Richard is a Gunji Jamara man from Portland who got up at 3:30 this morning to be here, and so much appreciated, Richard. He is also head of Willen Centre for Indigenous Arts and Culture here, and a wonderful colleague, Richard. Many of you will know Richard's history. He has such an extensive history, a soldier, fisherman, field officer during the 1988 Royal Commission on Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. Richard has written, directed and produced over 50 film projects, including the documentary No Way to Forget, which he'll show a part of today, and for which he became the first Indigenous director to win an AFI award in 1996. His 2014 stage production at the Malthouse Theatre, Walking into the Bigness, was nominated for 3 Green Room Awards for production, writing adaptation and ensemble work. He is also an acclaimed musician, and I asked him specifically today to bring his guitar. His music features on the soundtracks of many of his films, and in 1991, his first band, Jambi, supported Prince on his Australian tour. Richard's currently doing a lot of work around the treaty, and so I invite Richard as somebody who has a great commitment to his community, our community, and it's wonderful to have you here. And please, everyone, welcome Richard Franklin.
Thank you very much, and my respect to the traditional owners of this country, and my respect to all of you as well. I was at a funeral yesterday of an old fella who I've known since I was a boy, and who knew my grandfather, and he's buried up on Gunji Jamara country on Framingham Mission. One of the elders stood up and talked and said, "It's amazing how things have changed." He said, "I drove into town to come home for this funeral, and I seen the flag at half mast, the Aboriginal flag, in front of the police station. And things have changed, but we still live in a society where the access point to the wealth and power that the dominant culture holds, which is called white privilege, is still in the shape of the dominant culture. And it alienates us as a people from each other." The flag may have been at half mast, but the reality is simply that it's more likely for a young Aboriginal man to go to jail than it is to go to university. It's more likely that an Aboriginal mother will be incarcerated than see her children go to university. And it's more likely that we won't see the reduction of suicide amongst my mob for the next 5 years, because we're the highest, we have the highest suicide rate in the world. So, what is it that actually precludes us from getting through the access point to wealth and power, to holding knowledge and seeing the world through our eyes, as opposed to seeing the world through the dominant cultural eyes? What stops you guys from being able to step across the cultural abyss and see the loads that we as Aboriginal Australians carry? What's the ethical process that can make us meet in a way which enhances cultural safety and doesn't diminish cultural safety? Well, to understand that, first we have to know what culture is. And secondly, we have to know what cultural safety is. So culture is, there's 3 main points for culture. First point is, we all have culture. Everyone has culture in some way, shape or form. The second point is, we all need culture. If we don't have culture, what we have is a range of cultures that we tap into, and we're like a bit of a cork in a storm in the ocean. practice your culture, speak your language without fear of ridicule and condemnation. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. In fact, my people have 2,000 generations. And some anthropologists say that we were probably the richest people in the world because we were at a cultural pinnacle. We're at the top of the 1943 Maslow hierarchy. We were there. And in less than 10 generations, we've been royally rooted. So what does that actually, where does that actually place us now? It means that the access point to the wealth and power of a good quality of life, of jobs, of education, is in the shape of the dominant culture. And that the cultural safety that we once enjoyed for 2,000 generations is now hard to reach. How does it play out? It's quite an amazing type of thing to play out for me. I've seen it when I was born in this country. I wasn't a citizen of this country. As an Aboriginal person born before 1967, which gives away my age, and trust me, I make the middle-aged man noises when I get in and out of a car now. I have no idea why I do that, but I do. It seems to be a prerequisite of over 50. I wasn't a citizen, and I was excluded from a lot of the things that my non-Aboriginal colleagues were able to access. And it's hard to explain white privilege, isn't it? One of the ways I look at it is the street that I lived in later on in life when I was in my early teens. My non-Aboriginal mate, who's in my age group, had been in every house in that street, and I think I'd been in two in all the time I lived there, which is one way of explaining. The other way is, if I hold this hat up and I say, everyone grab a piece of paper and try and throw it in here, the front row is going to do it, probably get one in five, maybe two in five, the rest of you aren't going to have a hope in hell. And that's white privilege as well. That means that the starting point for us as a people is way back over here. So, what does that do when we negotiate an academic pathway with each other? Where does that place us? It says that there's two forces for and against cultural safety. And of course, it also depends on how we approach academia, what we think academia is for. Let's say that we're all good people with a good sense of right and wrong, and that we believe academia is about capacity building the world, making it a good and safe place, and enhancing the knowledge that we have, and about creating a safe society. Well, if it's about that, cultural safety in that context has two forces. There's a force for cultural safety, and there's a force against cultural safety. A force in my context, in the context of Aboriginal and Islander Australians, against cultural safety, is when an external process coming from the dominant culture, the colonisers or invaders if you like, tries to help and dictate terms and paradigms from up here. It tells us not only who we are, but what we are and how we should learn. So, it's reminiscent to me of the 37 legislations and policies that were created, developed and implemented in the removal of our children. Let's assimilate you. Let's make you white. The force for cultural safety is when we work like this. We empower a community to create, develop and implement programs in their own cultural shape, at their own pace, in their own way, to facilitate a resolution to their own problems or enhance their own society. So that's the context I wanted to talk about today. How's that sound? All right, good. So we'll talk about changing the world by conforming the access points to wealth and power and determining what wealth and power is to me as an Aboriginal man and what it appears to be through my cultural lens, the dominant culture. And strangely enough, I'm having having that conversation with a faceless large corporation at the moment over the treaty. So, we'll get into it then. So I'm a good Ngumara fellow, and I grew up in, I went to a lot of different, after my dad died, I was six, he was a non-Aboriginal fella, we lost all the white safeties. And the white safeties that he bought were things like, really simple things, being able to go into shops, tucker, a good safe home, and when he went, all of that disappeared, and we became a target for the welfare in all sorts of ways. And I remember them coming into my home as a boy and going through our cupboards, and I remember all my cousins being taken away that were living with us at the time. And in fact, I was talking to one of them on the phone the other day. He was in jail. He was taken about five or six, and he went through all the homes. I went and visited him a couple of times. He was in prison right up until his mid-50s, got out. He's getting a payout to the Stolen Generation mob, which is fantastic. But in jail, he was in protection a lot, and he's got all his teeth removed, so when they bashed him, he wouldn't get infections. But that was his life. And that occurred again and again with different cousins. I buried one the other day, and I've been to, I don't know how many funerals in the last couple of months, I'm not sure how many. And my first cousin passed, and all of her siblings were together for the first time in their lives since they were all forcibly removed. And I watched them standing at the side of the grave, and the chances of them going to university are like a snowflake's chance of surviving in hell. And that, again, to me, is an example of the massive cultural abyss that we have to traverse somewhere. So, what did I do? I ended up being a soldier. I went to two wars as a civilian, where I killed kids who'd been shot, smuggled the footage out. I wrote lots and lots of songs and poems. My non-Aboriginal colleagues in the army used to go boom bashing and coon kicking. I was better at violence than them. I came home. I ended up working at the Aboriginal Legal Service as a field officer. Covered the entire state, which is what you did back then, and you paid a third of your own phone bill and a third of your petrol, that was the norm, and you're on call 24/7. I remember going to police stations and seeing animal protection and the Aboriginal Legal Service number up on the wall, and bull was a common term, and quite often there was physical violence. RDA, I was appointed to the Royal Commission. I was the first Aboriginal investigator, and I covered 2.5 states, and I did that for 3 or 4 years, and then Caroline was here, and Sandra Bailey took over after I left, and did the inquiry into the social service desks. The investigations, the most common term I heard was "I can't recall," and a lot of people passed. The attitude was, in the Watch House book, you'd see things like "good bloke for an abbo." So we were dehumanised. And the access point to the wealth of power of dominant culture was unattainable. Later on, I made a few films. I had success at Cannes, was inducted into the Black Hollywood Hall of Fame. But still, I became the first Indigenous person to direct commercial television. And that was thanks to Gus Howard. Gus was producing, supervising producer of Blue Heelers at the time. And I felt it was very strange to direct something without having to worry about a funeral, a crisis in some way, shape or form. I was in culture shock. It was quite amazing. But I couldn't get a gig on any other show. In fact, one producer turned around to me and said, "I'm spending a minute talking to an Anglo male who's racist at that time. Their voice goes deep, and they spread their legs to show that they've got big bulldogs, excuse me, and they put their hands on the desk like that as a desk." That was the common thing. As soon as he did that, I knew government now, every position bar one is an identified position. Every position that an Aboriginal or older person is in are in identified positions. And I could quite clearly ask everyone in this room who may work across the cultural abyss, how many of you know an Aboriginal banker, real estate agent, etc., etc.? In fact, it's only been 3 decades since we've had Aboriginal people in power positions in universities, and every centimetre of that is hard fought for. And a lot of it comes about because we have courageous people, non-Aboriginal people, who help force open those doors. And some of you are in this room. How are we going so far? Are we all still on board? Is this helping? So what I did, I ended up investigating this case in custody, and it was probably the hardest job I ever did. I had to go through a bit of change myself, which is surprising. I ended up finding my sister who was taken doing that job, and we met in a car park in Bundoora. And nearly 30 years later, she's still coming home. And she was good kid when I met her, but they wouldn't tell me her name, and they wouldn't tell her that I was looking for her. In fact, the phone would ring at the office, and everyone would go silent. And I'd pick it up. I'd actually be shaking. But now, what was strange was that I was so used to taking people to meet their families. And some of the deaths I investigated, it was the first time all the kids had gotten together. Sometimes the mothers would call me their son's name, and that became a tool that I used in all sorts of ways. So we met. And 25, 27 years later, she's still coming home. But the chances of her getting into university are a long way off. The chances of her being some type of academic study are much more likely. Might take a break and sing you a song if you like. Many years ago, my sister Minnie, she's passed. She's very tough. I sang this at my cousin Glenison's funeral. Anyway, Minnie was that tough. We were up in Broome, I was about 15 or so. And the big bouncer there was knocking a few people about. So I was giving him a bit of a touch up. And the coppers jumped on me, as they do. Threw me in the back of the divvy van. I look out the divvy van window, which is a little box about this big, and there's my sister Minnie punching this bouncer. And these traditional ladies saying, "You get that arsehole Minnie, he barred me one time." Then she knocked him on his ass, let me out the divvy van, and we ran off. Before she pointed out this slab of beer, and said, "Grab that dick," which I did. We ran off into a broom seedist. She passed, and we went out and dug her grave and conned a vision by hand. I held the shovel up at the end. I said, "Oh, if you want to say goodbye, you can fill her grave in." What I was doing was conforming the access point my culture for her mates, a non-Aboriginal mate. Barney O'Connor, a little white fella, stood up first and grabbed the shovel. And for a moment in time, all we seen together was grief, which is in every colour. Certain memories calling, the winds are down. Blow through the air. And I heard you calling. third thing was the tone of voice, that she was angry at my mob for dying in jail. And I realised that we were fighting something far more heinous and disgusting than an individual full of hatred. An individual is easy to knock over. You ignore them, lock them out, heal them, stop them. But we were fighting something that was like a social cancer. And it had been socially engineered long before I was born, long before the white people set foot on this country. And it's a thing called discrimination. And we actually work very hard at creating discrimination. You know, we use terms that, we need more tolerance. Diversity is a problem. I think diversity is one of our greatest strengths. I think to conform the access point, we need diversity. So I started working at that time that with art as borders. And I made a commitment to myself that I would use film and music, the arts generally, to try and facilitate a voice to challenge the cultural tapestry of this nation, to make it a better place. To not be the one that gets examined all the time, but to use culture from my cultural lens, and to go across that cultural abyss and grab non-Aboriginal people by the hand and say, come back and have a look over here. I couldn't think of any other way to change the quality of life of my mob that would be best used by someone like myself. So it became a life's work, and then I ended up here. Now, I didn't make the choice to be an artist, per se. I would rather be a park ranger or a bushman, and well away from everyone. In fact, that's my retirement plan. I'm going home to cut wood, I'm going to buy a Lucas mill, and I'm going to try to have a go at learning how to do that. But what I find now is that I'm in this position where I've got the great honour of helping the VCA and the NCN facilitate change by recruiting all of these people into the world of art. And it's working so effectively. We're looking like we're auditioning the biggest mob from WA. And it's exciting. We've got in fact, it's so exciting because we've got the animation mob here recently grabbed a couple of my songs, and the young people drew their animation projects based on it. And I showed them to a couple of the old people out in the bush, and they got very excited. Now, I guess I'm going to show a film in a minute, but before I do, I want to talk a bit about the treatment. But I thought I'd pause here because I haven't got a structured speech. I'm all over the place like a madman's thoughts. But I thought I'd give you the chance to ask any questions you might have at this point before we change topic. create an interim body, nominated people, to facilitate a pathway towards a treaty. Wow, pretty amazing stuff. Now, why is a treaty so significant here in Australia? The last one that was done was by a bloke called Batten, where he ripped everyone off. So in this contemporary times, we're talking about facilitating change here in this state, which will echo across the nation. And that's great hope. And like it or not, we've all got the legacy of that job. In fact, as academics, we've got a huge responsibility to explore what does that actually mean? What does it look like? What can it mean? What type of hope can we give us as a nation? Do we have the courage to recognise the past for what it truly is, to plant seeds here in the present for future generations? And if we do have that courage, what does the process towards a treaty look like? And what can a treaty look like at the end? So the government approached me just recently and asked me to lead 16 sessions across the state to talk about the process towards a treaty. That's bloody huge responsibility. At first I said no. Sunday night I said no again. And then yesterday at the funeral, I realised that a lot of my mob have been on the front line and died to enable even a voice around, and that I've committed myself to facilitating voice. So I realised I didn't really have a choice. I realised that sometimes you don't get to choose your dreaming path, your life path. You choose how you conduct yourself on it. So I'm going to go on a bit of a journey. I know it's one that I'll need a bit of backup from some of you I can count on. So, this afternoon I'll go to the Premier's mob and have a bit of a yarn, tell them how I think it should be done. My idea is you go to the communities and have a meeting, but you also go and tap on a lot of doors, have a cup of tea, and you learn to listen. The objective of this is to give people's thoughts on a couple of things, and one of them is the shape of some type of representative body to facilitate our voice as people about a treaty. The second thing it's the opportunity for something I think that can change the nation again, and that is a quarantined election process where we see and hear the Aboriginal voice through an election process on issues that affect us directly, where we've been voiceless and we've been invisible. One of the greatest things, the greatest weapons of discrimination is exclusion and invisibility. When we're invisible, we're out of sight, out of mind. One of the ways to conquer discrimination and one of the ways to cripple discrimination is to make people visible and to be able to not only hear their voice, but to act upon that voice. So, the treaty may be the end goal, but I think the real achievements for us as a state and as a nation will be the rungs on the ladder that we build together, the pathway that we light up, and the potential pathways that we light up along the way towards a treaty. I think we'll be empowered to create great change and leave a strong legacy for our children in the future. So you're not going to have time to see the film that I was going to do because I've only got a couple of minutes left, but you will have time to ask a couple of questions if you like. Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit more what you mean by the quarantine election process?
Sure. The moment when we vote on issues such as recognise or constitutional recognition or treaty, we see the non-Aboriginal vote, we don't see the Aboriginal vote within that. What I want to try and do is see if Aboriginal people of Victoria might be three ways we could do it. We could do it using the census process. We could do it through the Aboriginal Community Control Organisations process. Or we could do it through the Vic Electoral Commission or a combination of all three. The idea is to make people visible, but also to tap into people who may be intimidated by lateral violence or by the dominant culture, if you like, and get them to actually stand up and have a say. How many leaders, how many contributors do we miss out on if we don't hear what they've got to say, or if we don't use our positions of responsibility and power to foster courage in them to stand up? G'day. It's happening here because of this government. So it's a short window of opportunity. So I'm grabbing it with both hands. I've got stuff that I don't want it. I would really like to do this. But you don't have a choice. And will it happen in other states? People are reaching out already. People are very excited. People are watching with great interest. Every society, it's like a man throwing a spear. When you throw a spear, you need your feet on the ground, on Mother Earth. You need your legs for balance and your hips, and you need your stomach muscles and your lungs for air and your arms for balance and your spear shaft and your spear point. You need your spirit. And we all take turns being the spear point. In this instance, in this issue, Victoria is the spear point. But it needs every Victorian to stand up and not be scared. You're going to be scared about it, step back and have a look about what can actually achieve. I'd encourage everyone to see this as a great opportunity for hope. And not everyone's going to agree. There's going to be a whole heap of people, black and white, who are going to see a problem before they see a resolution. My job is to offer up things which potentially lead to great resolution. Time for one more question. Yep.
Do you have a capture and development of this on the top?
Not me. I was just going to do this and then I'm going to take a couple of weeks off. we might have to talk about it. I think they're going to film the sessions. My mob are pretty traumatised. And it's hard. It's really hard to navigate through that trauma. And there's several different types of trauma that we as a people face. There's transgenerational trauma, which is not only about the point of contact, it's about exclusion. There's discrimination, which the big mental health studies show that incidents of discrimination not only decapitate your learning capability, but they give you high Kessler scores, physical, psychological stress scores. Navigating through that is a really difficult task. And we end up with a thing that I call poverty of spirit. And that means being stuck in a rut. And having all those blockers, discriminatory blockers, institutionalized, systemic discrimination, all those things. So this is about challenging that. And there's going to be a whole heap of challenges that we as a community, as individuals in that community, are going to have to make. And some of them are going to be about, do we want our voice to be public? I think it should be. I think we need to stand up and be counted in that context. I think we need to give that gift to the nation. What I'm interested in is who else feels that they're stakeholders in the treaty, because the treaty is about an agreement.